From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Boston. We start by talking with a journalist who live tweeted the police action early this morning in Watertown. Seth Mnookin had followed the police from the shootout at MIT to Watertown. He arrived after one of the suspects had been shot and killed. Then we'll hear from journalist Charles Sennett, who has covered war and terrorism in the Middle East, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Now he's covering terrorism in his hometown. And novelist Dennis Lehane, the author of Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone, which are set in his hometown of Boston, will describe his experiences this week. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we talk with two journalists and a novelist about their city being attacked and then under lockdown. Our first guest, Seth Mnookin, live tweeted from the scene of the police action in Watertown early this morning. After an MIT police officer was shot and killed, allegedly by the Marathon bombing suspects, Mnookin followed the police as they pursued the suspects to Watertown. Mnookin is a professor of journalism at MIT and a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. We spoke this afternoon. So how did you end up being on the scene of Watertown last night?
Well, I got an alert from the emergency alert system at MIT a little bit after 11 o'clock, alerting us about the shooting that had occurred on campus a couple of minutes earlier. And when I arrived, it was already turning into a sort of breaking news scrum where essentially it was a lot of reporters standing outside of a crime scene area. And so when all of a sudden a bunch of the police cars that were at the scene took off very quickly, I thought that it would make more sense if I was looking for new information to follow them as opposed to staying there. So I first followed them to what seems to be the site where the suspects let out the carjacking victim, which was a gas station in Cambridge, and then over to Watertown, where the firefight had just concluded.
Just give us an overview of what you saw in that firefight. Well, I guess it had just concluded, but what did you actually witness?
The first thing that I noticed is that the area in Watertown in which this took place is right behind several large shopping malls, but it's an incredibly residential area. And as soon as we got in that area, you could smell gunpowder and smoke in the air. That was very striking. Then when we got there, the thing that really struck me was the absolute confusion and chaos that was on the ground. The police officers who were there already had been instructed to turn off their cell phones for fear of detonating some sort of explosive device, but they were primarily Boston Police Department cops and not Watertown PD. So they weren't at all familiar with the area. So they were receiving directions over their radio to go to X and Y intersection and had no idea where that was and couldn't look on their smartphones to call up a map and access that. So there was this sense of chaos at the scene, exacerbated by the fact that they clearly felt that there were explosives in the area and there was no easy way that I think they or anyone else could see to contain what is, again, a residential area with dozens if not hundreds of people asleep or in their houses. So what we ended up seeing was someone who was certainly treated as a suspect told to get out of a car and then take off his clothes and lie down on the ground. He was eventually questioned by the FBI, and initially the Boston police indicated that he had been a suspect. And then about an hour later, they said that actually there was only one suspect, the one that did die, and this other person was just someone who had the really bad luck of being in the very wrong place at a very wrong time.
So you got to Watertown after the first suspect was shot?
Yes, right after the first suspect was shot, but when they believed the second suspect was still right in that area. So mm-hmm. What happened was that both suspects were in a car. One of the suspects was struck by a bullet and it seems may also have been injured by some explosive devices that the suspects had. And then the other suspect was able to essentially drive his way out. But when I arrived there, they still thought that he was in this fairly small area. And just to give a sense of how quickly changing the situation was, I got there, I followed the police, I parked my car, was standing talking to a policeman. 2 minutes later, someone comes running at me, another policeman comes running at me, screaming to get 100 yards back. They cordoned off then a several square block area. My car is in that area, and when I asked when I might be able to receive my car, this was at like 3:30 in the morning, they said not tonight and possibly not tomorrow.
So you don't have it back yet?
No, I don't have it back. And in fact, at one point there was talk of setting off a controlled detonation, and I realized that I had my large, bulky black backpack sitting on a seat in the car, and so I went and found a state police officer and said, you know, just so you know, you don't need to blow up my Subaru. That's not one of the suspect's vehicles.
Excuse me for laughing.
It was one of those situations where it was so nerve-wracking and the events were so tragic that both the cop who I was talking to and I had the same reaction. I think it was sort of nice to have something be ridiculous and not also tragic.
So explain this tweet to me. Not sure if this is why police wanted to use my phone, but they were told to shut theirs down because of detonation concern.
So again, I think that really just speaks to how confused the scene was. So they were told to shut down their phones, but because this was before a perimeter had been set up, there were no instructions that were given to me, and someone, one of the police officers, saw that I had a phone in my hand and so came up to me and said, can you show me where this street is?
Was there any concern that you had, having your cell phone on, that you might accidentally detonate a bomb? I mean, if the police were told to turn theirs off.
I realized why they didn't have their cell phones on, you know, after I showed him, the officer, where the street was that he was looking for, I then turned it off until we were however many, you know, 100 yards away, and they had set up a perimeter. And at that point, I just made sure that I was aware of what the police were doing so I could respond quickly if there were any further requests. But something else that I think really added to the confusion, and it might be hard for people who don't live in Boston to kind of fully grasp, but, you know, Boston itself is a very small city. It's about 600,000 people. And I think when people think of Boston, what they're actually thinking of is Boston and Cambridge and Watertown and Brookline and this sort of ring of surrounding communities. And because of this situation, moving from Boston to Cambridge to Watertown, you had multiple agencies that were not obviously used to doing big tactical operations together. Just on the scene there in Watertown, you had Boston police, who seemed to be the primary presence there. You also had Massachusetts State Police, and then you had Watertown and Newton Police. This definitely added to some of the confusion, and early on in the night, I think, added to some of the difficulty possibly in communication. There was one exchange that I overheard where some state police were trying to get an image from a member of the transit police, and for whatever reason, they weren't able to get it. One of the state policemen finally just sort of said, oh, this is wonderful, and that was that. And I think that's what you see when you have people who haven't worked together in this type of situation in an incredibly stressful and very dangerous scenario, all of a sudden kind of forced to operate as one.
So, Seth, you're a professor of journalism. Here you are, in the middle of the night, live tweeting a police action, trying to track down, like, terrorists. One of the suspects was already shot by the time you arrived on the scene. So you're live tweeting this. The ethics of live tweeting aren't completely hammered out yet. So as a professor of journalism, live tweeting, what are some of the things that went through your mind about what you should be saying and what perhaps you should not be saying?
Well, there were a couple things. Like, there was one time when very clearly a specific address was audible where they thought the suspects might be, and I didn't put that address out over the transom because I didn't see any reason why that would be valuable. Another thing I tried to do was, as often as possible, remind people that what they were getting from me was a sort of instantaneous, unedited snapshot of what was going on. And I tried to remind them that even if I was reporting something as being said to me by a police officer, that didn't necessarily mean that it was going to end up being true, as was the case when they thought that they had a second suspect. in custody, and it turned out they hadn't. Obviously not because the police officers were dissembling in any way, just because in any kind of fluid situation, your things are going to look one way, and then you move the picture slightly, and all of a sudden they look as if it's something completely different.
Is there is there anything that you regret having tweeted now that you know a little bit more, if you know more, about what actually went down in Watertown?
I'm sure there is, and I'll need to go back and look at my timeline, but I can't think of anything off that. Well, actually, there was one thing that I made a sort of snide comment about another reporter, not by name, but just another reporter who was at the scene and how they're reporting smelling smoke where we were, and you actually couldn't smell smoke. And, in retrospect, I think that was...
I've got that tweet right here. I'm just going to read it. Reporter next to me just said on phone, "Smell of gunpowder is overwhelming." And then you say, "There's absolutely no smell of gunpowder."
Right. Which, on the one hand, was true. On the other hand, it's an example of where, first of all, since I'm not on the other end of the conversation, I don't know what the context is. Maybe the question was, what was it like when you first arrived in Watertown or whatever? And even if he had been saying the smell of gunpowder at that moment was overwhelming, I think what tweets like that kind of don't acknowledge is that everyone there is in a really stressful, frightening, difficult situation. And people respond to stressful, frightening, difficult situations in all sorts of ways. I think a good rule of thumb is to be as generous as possible in your interpretations of what other people are doing and what your colleagues are doing. And that was an example of a time in which my snideness momentarily got the better of me.
Well, I wish you well. I thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Seth Mnookin is a journalism professor at MIT. He's also the author of The Panic Virus, The True Story Behind the Vaccine Autism Controversy. Coming up, we talk with journalist Charles Sennett about covering a terrorist attack in his hometown after covering terrorist attacks in the Middle East, Iraq, and Afghanistan. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Charles Sennett, has reported on terrorist attacks in the Middle East, Afghanistan, Iraq, Ireland, Europe, and Oklahoma City. Now he's reporting on the attack in his hometown and the subsequent lockdown. Sennett is a former Middle East bureau chief for the Boston Globe and is the founding executive editor of the international news website Global Post. He writes a column for its blog, Ground Truth. We spoke to him this morning. He was speaking to us from his home in Boston. Charles, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
So what has it been like for you? I mean, we used to speak by phone when you were in Iraq, covering the war there. And now,
yeah.
You know, you've seen, you know, two explosions in your hometown. So what's it like when it happens in your hometown?
Well, it's different. It feels like suddenly, you know, of course, it's a lot closer to home physically, but it's just these streets are the streets I grew up in, and these are the people I know. And Patriots Day is a day in Boston that is the best day in Boston, when it seems like there's almost always good weather, and we have the Red Sox playing, and the marathon is such a great tradition, proud sense of history, the anniversaries of the battles in Concord and Lexington, and you think this is this pageant of just life and a great city. And I think when we saw these events unfold, I started to really ask myself, why does it feel so different that these victims have a Boston accent? You know, the same people I grew up with, or that it's a student from China. And Boston, of course, is all about students from all over the world coming to the city. This is different, and I think it is different because suddenly you realize that that every time you cover a bombing, it's someone's hometown. And I think this bombing has reminded me of that, that maybe we've covered so many bombings over so much time in Belfast, in Pakistan, Oklahoma City, Jerusalem, Kabul, Madrid, London. Maybe all of this somehow gets you at some point inured to the meaning of it for the people who have gone through it. And it's a horrible shock to Boston. It's a tough, resilient town. But it's a reminder to me as a journalist from here that we've got to bring that same emotion as much as we can every time, everywhere in the world, because wherever a bombing happens, it's someone's hometown.
Where are you right now?
So I'm in my home right now, outside of Boston, to the west of Boston. It is an extraordinary set of events, you know, that have been unfolding in Boston. You talked about tweeting. I just tweeted that, you know, very simply, many more questions than answers right now, but feels more like dog day afternoon than, you know, dark 0:30.
Zero dark 30, but why does it feel more like dog day afternoon?
Well, because this is taking us inside a journey into two young brothers. And we're going to try to understand what motivated them to do something this violent, this horrific. And I think that when you get inside these worlds, it's like that often with covering bombings. In Madrid, we had to get inside the North African immigrant community in Madrid. In London, we traveled out to Leeds and we started to look inside that community of Pakistani immigrants who felt alienated. I think this time we're going to be on a journey to understand the inner workings of a family dynamic where apparently these two brothers felt very disaffected from their other members of their family. You know, we've now heard from the uncle who spoke from suburban Maryland, from his home. And he was asked, why do you think they would do that? And his answer was, you know, those who did that are losers, people who couldn't settle successfully. And, you know, that's a revealing comment about who these guys are, or who at least the older brother is. Because we also have that hit from the older brother on his Facebook page where he talked about not being able to understand Americans, not liking Americans. He doesn't get them, as he said. This is Tamerlan, the one who has now been killed, the 26-year-old brother, the brother in the dark hat in the photographs. And then you have the younger brother, you know, who we're getting a picture of. Zakhar is known more commonly, I guess, around Cambridge, where he went to high school at Cambridge Ringin Latin High School, as Jahar. And he's supposed to be this sweet, innocent, nice young kid. I mean, the words coming out about him are glowing. So how do we square this? Was it an older brother influencing a younger brother inside a family that had been fractured by displacement and political asylum here in the United States, you know, who had seen their family have to flee the war in Chechnya? How did they end up here? What kind of alienation did that cause, and what role does that play?
What else have you learned about the brothers?
I mean, what we're learning is just in bits and pieces, but those bits and pieces are coming together pretty quickly. Talking to high school students who were at Cambridge Ringin Latin, very famous high school in Cambridge, and that's where Zokhar Tsarnaev graduated in 2011. He then went on to University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth, and you know, just sort of following the path of so many immigrant kids in the city of Boston. You know, we have immigrants in Cambridge from all over the world who come to settle there and who go to that high school and who go on to do good things. And those who knew him and called him Jahar was what they referred to him as, said that this was a kid who was just, you know, a great kid, someone who they couldn't imagine doing this, that he was a trained lifeguard who worked at Harvard University. He was a good student, you know, went on to college. And I think what we're hearing then from the analysts and the people I know who cover terrorism and who do profiling within the CIA and the FBI of terrorists, they're asking questions like, well, we're really looking at how the 19-year-old may have been led by the 26-year-old. The older brother, Tamerlan, who's now dead, really was more disaffected from everything we can gather. And from looking at his own posts on Facebook, this was someone who had a very different spirit than his younger brother. And I think that dynamic, getting inside of personal relationships between two young brothers, is going to be a big part of this. I mean, all of this is taking so many turns. I don't want to try to guess on anything, but I do think that's a big area of questioning. What what was the influence of the older brother on the younger brother, and did he encourage him to try to bring meaning to their lives through some expression of violence?
Charles Sennett speaking to us earlier today from his home just outside Boston. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. He's the founding executive editor of the international news website Global Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Celebrating Fresh Air's 25 years, the Neubauer Family Foundation salutes WHYY and listeners like you, committed to new ideas and civilized conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing reviews of local contractors, dentists, electricians, and mechanics to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. From soprano Sarah Brightman with her new album, Dream Chaser, including the single, One Day Like This. More at sarahbrightman.com. And from Subaru, introducing the all-new 2014 Forester. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Learn more at subaru.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, we talk with best-selling novelist Dennis Lehane about having his hometown attacked and under lockdown. His novels Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone are set in Boston. And we continue our conversation with journalist Charles Sennett, who has covered terrorist attacks around the world and is now covering one in his hometown. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Charles Sennett. He's covered terrorist attacks in the Middle East, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and other parts of the world, and is now covering the attack in his hometown. He's a former Boston Globe Middle East correspondent and is the founding executive editor of the international news website Global Post. He writes a column for its blog, Ground Truth. So, what are some of the dangers you're trying to avoid reporting on a live breaking news story?
That's a really great question. And I think the best answer to that is an example. When I came back from Pakistan in 1995 and I was researching sort of, you know, the rise of Islamic extremism, and I had come off of the 1993 World Trade Center bombings. And I came home like days before Oklahoma City. And I remember it because it was almost Patriots Day, and I remember very well that I just wanted to go to the Red Sox game, but my editor said, you have to immediately get to Oklahoma City. This is going to be Middle Eastern terrorism. And we sort of dutifully marched off out of the newsroom, myself and a photographer, and went to Oklahoma City, and all the networks are reporting the hallmarks of Middle East terrorism. And, of course, when we got there in Oklahoma City, the story became about a young soldier named Timothy McVeigh and his relationship with another character named Terry Nichols and their journey through a certain part of America and gun shows and the NRA and the Patriot movement. And I think of that story now, and I think it would have been so easy to presume and to say all the vectors are pointing toward this bombing on Marathon Day being the Patriot movement because of the anniversary. But here we get another twist again, that now it's actually about Chechens who are immigrants here. Whether it's about a cause connected to Chechen separatists, we don't know. But they're an immigrant family, and we're going to have to try to ask those questions. And I think never presume you know where it's going to go, because that is the truth of getting inside these underworlds that explode in this kind of violence, is just follow the story where it leads you. Don't try to guess.
Charlie, you have reporters around the world who file for Global Post. Are you getting reactions from around the world to the bombings in Boston and to the manhunt that's underway?
I mean, we've been getting reactions really from the very beginning, and strong messages of support, not only on the website where we've seen a lot of that attached to our coverage, but even just individually from our editors and reporters who are either have worked all over the world or are still out there based in many cities all over the world. Unbelievably warm messages of support. You know, I had these young reporters in Cairo send me these really dear messages about how worried they are. And people from Baghdad who I've worked with who say, be safe. You know, to be getting a message from Baghdad telling those of us in Boston to be careful and be safe is, I think, a big part of this story that's unfolded in Boston, that none of us are immune, no city is immune to this kind of violence, and it will all be judged on how we react to it and the kind of strength and resiliency we show in getting over it. Of course, we've seen that with that beautiful interfaith service yesterday, but also how do we deal with the culprits, and how do we deal with our own anger toward those who did it, and what are we going to bring to that, I think, is a question that will still unfold over the next few days, weeks, months.
Well, more immediately, you've been exposed to so many wars and terrorist attacks. What advice do you have for your fellow Bostonians about how to deal with what they're going through right now?
Mm-hmm. I think Boston's a tough town and never likes to be told what to do. So I would never presume to want to tell my town what to do. I wouldn't even tell my family what to do. But I think that it is doing the right things, which it has pulled together. It has been heroic in terms of the first responders. It's been selfless in terms of the civilians who just went right forward to help those who were injured at that finish line. And it's been reflective about faith, which, you know, is a very important part of the fabric of life in Boston and in all of America, and maybe you could say even all the world. I mean, going to faith is a big issue, I think, that I see it through a lot of the communities here. And I think these are all very healthy responses to getting through it and being resilient and recognizing that this city will not be cowed in fear because of the violence of two individuals who President Obama described yesterday as stunted individuals. I think we get that in Boston. I think a bigger question for Boston will be, how do we deal with the culture of revenge? You know, it's famously been said that Boston cares about three things: sports, politics, and revenge. Okay, that's a line. But really, how are we going to deal with the fact that these were two young brothers who lived in Cambridge? One went to Bunker Hill Community College. The other went to UMass Dartmouth. These are not unlike all of our sons and nephews in our own families, who we're all immigrants too. We all went to those public high schools, and we went on to those public colleges. But here are two that turned against this community and hurt it badly. Are we going to judge them just as individuals, and look at the idea of prosecution and look at the idea of justice? Or will we make the mistake of widening it out and making it somehow about religion or about bigger ideas when it may or may not be about that?
Well, Charles Sennett, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure.
Charles Sennett spoke to us earlier today from his home just outside Boston. He's the founding executive editor of the international news website Global Post. Coming up, we talk with Dennis Lehane about his experiences in Boston this week. His novels Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone are set in his hometown, Boston. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Dennis Lehane is a native Bostonian who has set most of his novels in the city, including the bestseller Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone. We called him earlier today to talk about seeing his city attacked and then put under lockdown. Dennis Lehane, thank you for joining us. So first, just describe to us where you are right now in Boston without giving us the address of your home.
Sure. We're in this place where Boston, Alston, Brighton, the Alston Brighton neighborhood of Boston and Brookline meet. So essentially right near Boston University, and directly across the river from MIT.
So you're in shutdown right now. You're locked down.
Yes.
Just tell me what's been going through your mind today as you're trapped at home. And Bostonians have no idea what to expect.
There's that. You know, absolutely, there's a sense of this, you know, very dangerous loose cannon out there, and that's giving everybody pause. The streets are empty. Nobody's leaving their home. Everybody's taking this very seriously. That's been a big thing that's going through my head. I probably know some of the members of law enforcement involved right now, and that's given me a little pause.
Because you're worried about them?
Yeah, that sense of, I hope nobody I know steps into the line of fire. It's a very selfish thought, but of course that's what we think of. We think of the people we know first, and then we, you know, extrapolate from there. So, and then, you know, just in general, this sense of something that we're all just processing. I mean, you say, well, I'm not panicking. Well, are you not panicking because you're in shock, or are you not panicking because you're processing, or you're not panicking because panic wouldn't help? What are you going to do? You just do the best you can. You watch the news reports. You hope for the best and keep an eye on your kids.
So what are you doing? Are you just like reading Twitter feeds and watching the news and listening to the radio?
I'm going back and forth. My daughter, because they keep playing, my daughter seems to be blissfully ignorant of what's going on until they start replaying the tape of the gunfight in Watertown last night. And so when she hears the gunfire, she says, "Daddy, that movie scares me." So we've been either turning it off or then checking our computers, or, you know, we've been kind of catch as catch can on it.
How old is she?
She's almost four.
How are you describing all this to her?
So far, so good. So far, she hasn't engaged it except to say it's a scary movie. So she doesn't quite understand that this is going on.
You write about criminals. You write about crime. Have you been trying to think, who are these guys?
Yeah,
what's been going
sure.
through their minds?
I mean,
why did they do this?
The why to me is... it's not at all surprising to me that one of the first things you heard about the suspects was that they said they had no American friends, that they've been in this country at least 5 years, but they never felt part of the society. And they say that's usually building block A for creating any type of terrorist, whatever their cause. is that you should feel that you feel ostracized from the society that you're in. And so that's, you know, that was something that I felt right from the beginning, was whoever these guys are, whatever the cause they've wrapped themselves in, that's not going to be the real reason. And I feel that about jihadists. I feel that about white supremacists. I feel that about, you know, militia idiots like Tim McVeigh. It's really not. It's the cause they grabbed to deal with the other issue. And the other issue is isolation, or the other issue is rage, or the other issue is we don't know exactly what the other issue will turn out. But it will turn out to be something very human, and in some small way it'll turn out to be something very pathetic. And then this, what was the click that drove them to get to the point where they could be so desensitized that they could knowingly kill and maim children? I don't know, because I can't get to that click.
Where were you Monday?
I was here. I was at my home. And then I noticed that my cell service went down. My wife got through on a landline and then said there's a rumor that there was some sort of explosion at the marathon. And then I turned on the TV. It was within, I think, 10 minutes. I turned on the TV, and there was the beginning of it. And you knew immediately once you saw the second one. You know, it's the first one was, oh, that could have been a gas explosion. 9 seconds later, you see the second one a block away, and you say, oh, that's it. This is terrorism. And then I went and walked out on the street, and I walked over to the marathon route and, you know, just looked at people. The things that I'll never forget were that, you know, everyone was hugging and everyone was checking their phones over and over because they couldn't get service. So looking at them over and over and over again and you know, pounding them with their fingers.
You strike me as somebody who wants to be where the action is when you can, wants to know about it. When you heard about the attack at the Boston Marathon, you walked to where the marathon finish line was, as close
not
as you could get.
Not to the finish line, no. I did
as
not
close
go
as
to
you
finish
could
line.
Get. Yeah, no,
I'm a
I mean, father. No, nobody could. No,
right.
Nobody could. But now, like, except for the police, no one could get to where anything is. Like, you have no choice but to stay home. And
right.
I guess I'm wondering what that feels like, knowing, like, you have no choice but to stay home, and neither does anybody else. And in that sense, there's, like, no action going on except for what the police know about and what the police are trying to do.
If it were another city, I might feel different. I have such a somewhat proprietary bond toward this city. I have such an embracement of it that I feel like, you know, my friends in blue are out there doing their job. And so, you know, we'll just hang out until they tell us it's an all clear. It feels personal in the best possible way.
Well, Dennis Lehane, I really want to thank you for talking with us. I wish you the best. I wish your city the best. I hope this ends soon in a positive way. And thank you for your books. Thank you for your time today. And I spent a fair amount of time in your city. I love your city, and I wish it good things.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Terry. I hope for the same thing.
Dennis Lehane recorded earlier today from his home in Boston. His novels set in Boston include Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone. We'll close today's show by taking a deep breath and listening to some good music with a strong Boston connection. This is an excerpt of the 1988 concert we recorded with Dave McKenna. He was the longtime pianist at the bar in the Copley Plaza Hotel, which is just a couple of blocks from the Boston Marathon finish line. McKenna died in 2008 at the age of 78. We hope you enjoy this music. Dave McKenna, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a complete pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Terry.
And I'd like to ask you to introduce the first song you'd like to play.
Okay, this is a tune by Dietzen Schwartz called By Myself.
beautiful. You know, I especially like hearing you perform solo. And I think the reason is that your sense of rhythm is so strong. It's like you're accompanying yourself. And I just assume not hear anybody with you so I can hear completely what it is you're doing. And I was wondering if you especially like playing solo.
Well, of course, it's the way I make my living now. But it's fun to play with a band. I don't, the bass piano duo thing or the piano trio thing doesn't work with me because it's that in-between thing. I don't think I ever got that down. But I really love playing with bass and drums and a horn or two, you know, trumpet and saxophone and some, a guitar, too. I love that. But I play it a different way then. And it's just, it really is fun. But anything less than four pieces, I'd rather be alone, I think. Because I can, it's great working with good bass players, and there are plenty of them now, and drummers. But this way I can change tempo. I'd have to work with a bass player for years and just change or change tunes, you know, and you, when you play solo, you just, a lot of it is just killing time, killing the clock.
You think so?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, one more question before we get to the next song. That was just called By Myself, what you just played. And I think of you as having gone by yourself in a way of being a bit of a loner, playing, you know, for long stays in a supper club or in a hotel and having lots of people come to you, and you have a home base, which is something very few people in jazz have the luxury of.
Yeah, I've really been lucky that way.
You know, I want to ask you, I know that for the past 9 years or so, you've been at the Copley in a very elegant bar there. A lot of times when people go into a bar, they're pleased that there's music, but they don't necessarily know the first thing about music or the first thing about their hearing, about what they're hearing, and they might talk while the musician is playing. How does that affect you when people are talking and you're playing?
That's cool. It's such a comfortable situation. The Copley, most people who come in the room aren't coming in to hear me because a lot of them are convention people or from the hotel. And they're just in for a drink in nice surroundings. And so it's not a concert, and I don't expect to. In many cases, it's easier playing because I can, you know, I just play lightly and fiddle around and play. If you think of what I'm going to play next, there's no pressure. I could play quietly a good part of the night, and I usually come up a little bit in volume at the end of a set to let them know I'm near, that I've been working. And some nights people listen, and a lot of times they don't, but essentially it's a background music gig, really, and I'm happy with it. I mean, I've been happy with it, and I had 9 years or so, and I like staying in Boston. It was a nice stay at the hotel. It's walking distance from brought anything in town, including the ballpark, and everything's handy in that city. Yeah.
We're listening back to a 1988 concert with the late Dave McKenna, who was the longtime pianist at the bar in the Copley Plaza Hotel in Boston, which is just a couple of blocks from the Boston Marathon finish line. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're closing today's show with music that has a strong Boston connection, our 1988 concert with the late pianist Dave McKenna. For about 10 years, he was the pianist at the bar in the Copley Plaza Hotel in Boston. You know, sitting right next to you at the piano, I'm really watching your hands carefully, and you have such a strong left hand when I hear your records. And your left hand is almost gently approaching the keyboard. I mean, you don't seem to be exerting yourself with your left hand at all.
I try to work hard. I'm not really adept. I can play, if I play it with some strength, then it gets kind of sloppy. I came to stride piano late. I only use it for a few bars at a time, but that's real work. I stand in awe of those guys that play it all the time, you know.
How
Ralph
did...
Sutton, Dick Wellstone.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
They really play it hard and accurately, you know. And
is accurate hard when you're playing stride?
Yeah, I think so. Because they've been playing it a long time. You know, some guys made a specialty of it, and their whole career was based on that. You know, the older guys, Fats and James P., those are the guys that invented it, I guess. But as far as the working bass, that sort of just playing bass notes, that just seemed to come naturally to me, and it's not much exertion required there.
Were you self-taught, or was there a pianist who
studied
carefully with?
I had lessons from... My first teachers were the nuns and parochials. I went to my mother's a real good musician, though. She played piano and violin, but she didn't want to teach, so she sent me the nuns. And I didn't really like to practice, but I could always pick tunes out that I heard on the radio and always played by ear, it seems, since I was about 7 years old. So I had a couple of good teachers, a guy in Boston, Sandy Sanford, who was a jazz musician of sorts. I mean, he was a good jazz player, but he made his living writing showbiz charts for the singers around Boston. But he didn't, I was 16 or so by the time I went to him, and he didn't really fool with the way I played. He just made a few suggestions into how to organize it. And he said, why don't you make a little arrangement of this? And the lessons were kind of spotty because I was still living in my parents' house, and I didn't get up there often. But he had some nice suggestions anyway.
We're going to have time for one more song, and can I make a request?
Yeah.
Would you play Thanks for the Memory?
Of course.
The late Dave McKenna recorded in our studio in 1988. For about 10 years, he played in the bar at the Copley Plaza Hotel, which is just a couple of blocks from the Boston Marathon finish line. Our thoughts will continue to be with everyone in Boston. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Henry Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our associate producer for online media is Nell Beschenstein. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Sony Classics with The Company You Keep, directed by and starring Robert Redford, about one man trying to outrun his radical past, now in select theaters. From the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture, poetryfoundation.org. And from Nonesuch Records, presenting Ghost on Ghost, the new album from Iron and Wine, available now on Amazon.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Zubiquity, the astonishing connection between human and animal health. We talk with Dr. Barbara Natterson Horowitz about what the animal world has to tell us about human health and sexuality. She's a cardiologist who consults at the Los Angeles Zoo. Join us.